What do packaged food items in supermarkets, traffic signs on the streets, and carbon labels in restaurants have in common? Any idea? What might sound like the beginning of a highly impractical joke actually concerns the topic of public policy, to be more specific, behavioral public policy, with all examples above mentioned being use cases for this relatively new emerging topic of research. But what exactly is behavioral public policy? Behavioral public policy, in the essence, leverages insights from psychology and behavioral economics to design and implement public policies more effectively. It recognizes that we humans are not always rational decision makers and often need prompts in the right direction to make choices that are good for everyone. Take a moment to think. How many times have you actually chosen a salad over a cheeseburger just because it had a green label signaling that it is a healthier choice? That is behavioral public policy in action. Now you may ask yourself, why does it matter? Do we really need that? Well, it matters because it addresses complex societal problems, from obesity to climate change, through subtle interventions in our day-to-day decisions. To delve deeper into this fascinating subject, we are incredibly privileged to have with us today none other than Professor Donald P. Green from Columbia University. Professor Green is a political scientist whose work has significantly shaped our understanding of voting behavior, prejudice reduction, and field experimental methods. His insights have often been foundational in developing effective behavioral interventions in public policy. Stay tuned as we navigate this thought-provoking world of behavioral public policy, with Professor Green discussing its profound implications for our societies and possible for even our daily lives. My name is Philip Tamer, and this is On Point Politics. Enjoy the interview. With us today is Professor Dr. Donald P. Green from Columbia University. First of all, a warm welcome. Today we will discuss the topic of behavioral public policy. This might sound a bit confusing, as one might ask oneself how public policy and behavioral insights are related. To shine some light into this topic, let's start with an introductory question. How would you describe behavioral public policy in your own words?
I would say it's a kind of mashup between traditional economic logic and more, say, contemporary psychological models of how humans behave. So maybe the kind of traditional economic model that would have been fashionable when I was an undergraduate would have focused on material incentives. You know, if you want people to conserve energy, raise the price of energy. Whereas a more behavioral approach might say, well, that's not the only way you could get people to conserve. You might appeal to their better nature or to their public spiritedness or their patriotism, or some other kind of thing, the social comparisons between them and their neighbors in order to shame them into doing it. And so some combination of coercive, extractive kinds of costs and benefits more traditionally, and more sort of social psychological appeals more contemporary.
Thank you so much for these introductory words. I think what's most important of your definition is that behavioral public policy adds a variety of different components to the public policy toolkit by taking into account perspectives of psychology or like decision science. So when we look at the practical side of behavioral public policy, how do these measures differ from traditional policy interventions, like the uses of the price
mechanism,
for example?
In some ways they don't, but in some ways the idea is that a kind of behavioral approach begins where more sort of extractive or coercive approach reaches its limits in places where either the state is weak or where administrative capacity is lacking. You often reach a kind of upper bound in terms of what you can get out of people through sort of force or taxation. And so you'd like to take a less expensive route of appealing to people on some other dimension that might be cheaper on the margin. Whether it is in fact cheaper on the margin really is going to depend on circumstances. But if, for example, you can get people to conserve water during a shortage by appealing to their sense of civic duty, well, it's a lot cheaper to do that than to release this kind of massive administrative arm of policing and enforcement. So I would say that the two are not necessarily incompatible, but they are they're somewhat different in terms of their approaches. And one of the concerns that the more traditional economists express about the more contemporary approaches is eventually people become inured to these kinds of appeals and start to ignore.
Yeah, I think this is a very important point you brought up there, pointing out that behavioral measures rather focus on the individual agency, aiming to result in appealing policies, which ends up being less costly for the implementers. But this is obviously not only a matter of cost effectiveness. As you rightfully mentioned, we are taking a lot of other factors into account when considering behavioral interventions. So which factors do behavioral public policy interventions take into consideration, which traditional policy measures cannot account for?
Well, I would say that in some ways, it all depends on what we're trying to achieve. So for example, you might say, well, in order to get people to serve in the military, why don't we just, arrest them if they don't show up, or let's pay them a high wage, or let's essentially give a combination of carrots and sticks. Another approach would be, let's try to give them a sense that they're going to be revered for their military service. They're going to be honored. It's going to be something that they can proudly display on holidays. And those kinds of appeals are not incompatible with one another. But notice that it's not just a matter of getting warm bodies into the military. It's also a matter of how they're going to behave when they're in the military. And maybe you'd be better off if you're leading troops to lead willing troops. So this is, I think, the trade-off. What kinds of things do we want people to do in the short run? And what do we want them to do when they're actually playing the roles that we've assigned them?
Yeah, what I really found interesting was going beyond this classical idea of negative or positive reinforcement, which is what you call the classical carrot on the stick example. So when looking at the previously mentioned endogenous and exogenous factors involved in behavioral public policy, we find ourselves with a lot of different factors which could eventually influence the outcome of these implementations, which might distort our intended outcome. So how can policymakers actually ensure that these measures are therefore being implemented equitably and also rather responsibly?
I think it's a great question, and it has many implications. One of them is pilot testing. So one of the first things one would want to do by way of a pilot test is to look for what are called heterogeneous treatment effects. So if you're going to, for example, encourage people to donate blood, if only the people who feel the greatest sense of moral responsibility in fact donate blood, then of course the costs and benefits of that kind of approach are going to fall disproportionately on some people and not others. And so one of the questions is, does everybody respond to an appeal? And if not, is there a kind of systematic skew in terms of the people who respond? It could be a skew that is either positively correlated with affluence or negatively correlated with affluence. And so we might be pleased to learn that this is not a case of expanding inequality, or we might be appalled to find that it is. So these are, I think, the immediate concerns. But then they're the long run concerns. To what extent can we do this without any kind of undergirding of costs and benefits? Rules and laws and punishments and blandishments. These are the idea that you're going to do this solely through non-material incentive appeals is daunting, especially in the long run, because there's the concern that eventually people will burn out in terms of their intrinsic motivations.
Yeah, I totally agree with you in this sense. I think the idea of intrinsic motivation is quite crucial to point out when discussing behavioral insights. So when I looked into your literature, I came across the idea of need for cognition, describing the individual's tendency to engage in active cognitive efforts. So previously we talked about the idea of individual agency, which aligns with this idea of need for cognition. So how can this need for cognition influence public policy measures, and how can we appeal to it?
Need for cognition is kind of a funny variable in that it enters into the behavioral or policy calculus in both a positive way and a negative way. The positive way is that you could get people to break out of the habits that you're trying to wean them off of, because now they're going to stop and think and perhaps reflect on considerations that they hadn't previously reckoned with. But the other concern is growing out of the theories of persuasion that say that to the extent that people are counter-arguing with the kind of appeals that you're making, you really don't want them to have a great deal of need for cognition, or at least to go into deep thinking, because then they're going to reject what you're saying, which is why, you know, one behavioral policy approach is to use entertainment or narrative messaging to draw people into perspective taking, or draw people into the moral of the story in a way that circumvents this kind of counter arguing. So whether cognition, active cognition, is helping the goals of the policymaker or running counter to them is going to depend on you know, how things are deployed.
That's true. I mean, we can really see here that context matters, as you mentioned, how things are deployed. So looking at this from an operational perspective, this again could lead to distortions regarding the individual proneness to behavioral interventions, right? So are there any other factors which can influence the individual proneness to behavioral interventions? And to what extent can we actually quantify them?
Well, it can certainly be quantified, but the difficulty is whether there is a kind of causal law that in general suggests that people who are prone to this or that behavioral appeal would be prone to some other behavioral appeal, perhaps in a different domain. And that has yet to be demonstrated. It's true that correlationally, there are lots of associations. So it's not an accident that, you know, the places where you have the highest rates of blood donation also tend to be the highest rates of other kinds of pro-social activities. But whether that is causative is really up for grabs. It's also been rather frustrating for people who work in mass communications research to find the persuadable people. What they typically find instead is that when you appeal to people, everybody more or less moves, and they move by about the same amount. Some people are closer to a behavioral threshold because they started closer to the threshold. And if all if everybody's moving, they're going to hit that threshold faster. But it seems as though, you know, one of the things that's kind of perplexing and interesting theoretically is that it doesn't seem to be the case that there are massive heterogeneous treatment effects. Now, yeah, that can differ when behavioral appeals are deployed by, let's call them, influencers, and they could be influencers who are controversial. So to the extent that, for example, a left-wing influencer makes a pronouncement, it might provoke very different responses from both left-wing followers and right-wing detractors, and vice versa. So you could have a situation where you have heterogeneity, but typically that's based on some kind of identity-connected appeal, yeah, as opposed to an information appeal.
Yeah, I mean, this is a really crucial aspect, stating the difficulty of finding causal relationships with the lack of homogeneity. Therefore, behavioral interventions are also being criticized. So this is what I came across when I had a look at predominant literature, as it's very, very hard to filter out the individual effect sizes or the causal relationships, which we previously talked about. So when thinking about the practicability, how can this challenge actually be overcome? Is there a common way, or are there any steps which have to be undertaken? And maybe also a quick follow-up question. I mean, there's this classical standard of randomized control trials, so a total randomization to really filter out any effects. Is this still kind of the gold standard to resolve this issue?
Well, there certainly are a lot of randomized control trials to evaluate the effects of nudges and non-nudges, for that matter. But essentially, that literature needs to advance to the next level, where you're holding constant the subject pool and asking, how does the same subject pool respond to either a variety of different kinds of appeals, or different the same kind of theoretical appeal, but on different outcomes? So is it the case that the same theoretical appeal works for blood donation and water conservation, okay, and so on and so forth? It's unclear. And part of the reason it's unclear is because these studies are typically done, and you can understand why, typically done by disconnected research groups. So they are not part of some broader research project. They're basically working as independent agents. And so although they might be interested in coordination and accumulation of knowledge, it's not really their primary design objective. Yes. So as a result, the literature is kind of a, you know, it's kind of like a crazy jungle of different findings, and it's very hard to summarize it coherently. So essentially, we need some government, we need some coordination among the different studies. And this idea is part of the so-called Medicare initiative by groups like the Evidence and Governance and Politics Group, where they're trying to bring together consortiums of researchers to study the same thing, but in different contexts.
Yeah, that sounds like there's still plenty of room for testing observations in different contexts, and also a lot of room for further research on this matter, which I find very, very appealing with regards to this topic. So speaking of the appeal of behavioral public policy, there seems to be a favorite type of intervention. You previously mentioned it. It is the nudge. So for those listeners that have never heard that word before, a nudge is a non-coercive policy instrument aiming to direct decision-making in a certain direction via subtle cues. So a good example for this is the Nutri-Score on food packaging, for example, where a certain nutritional value of a product is assigned via a color code. So looking at this prominent example, what do you think of nudges as a behavioral public policy instrument? Do you think they are actually quite effective, given the fact that they are being applied quite often?
I would say that it really depends on the nudge. You know, in some cases, the nudge is something like a default that you check once and becomes your, you know, your go-to option. And those seem to work rather well. Very often, the really subtle, tricky bank shot type nudges prove to be disappointing, like encouraging people to vote as opposed to being a voter. I mean, that's a subtle linguistic twist. And I think there was a literature that grew up with enthusiasm about that, but it tended to peter out without much fanfare. So I think that maybe too subtle would be likely to go down in flames, but something in the middle might work. One of the things that tends to work rather well is some version of social comparisons. You know, almost everything we do in life is in some ways guided by social norms. And, you know, social norms are very important to us. And, you know, if you don't believe that, just, you know, call somebody out for littering sometime and you'll immediately see a reaction, I hope not violent, but it'll certainly be emotional. And the reason is that all of us grew up as children being scolded, and being scolded for violating a norm is very painful emotionally. So that kind of appeal can often be quite powerful, especially when there's monitoring and surveillance and feedback, but it's also quite unpleasant for people. And so in some ways, the question is it sustainable given that it's aversive? I think people would rather be, in some sense, fined for littering than called out for it, photographed and shamed.
Oh, yes, I think this evokes some rather strong feelings when experiencing coercive policies, which is also mentioned by predominant literature as kind of a critical remark. But not only this. So when we look at nudging, current literature seems to focus on ethical concerns regarding nudges. So when we look at the core idea of nudges, they aim to act in a libertarian paternalistic manner. So this might sound like an oxymoron to some listeners, but actually this means that choices should be altered in a paternalistic manner while maintaining individual choice architecture. So nevertheless, I feel nudges might not leave room for maintaining individual freedom of choice, because they really aim to direct the choices in a certain direction, right? So are they actually libertarian paternalistic or just simply paternalistic?
Well, it's a little bit above my pay grade to weigh in on these kinds of normative theoretical issues, but I guess I would say that the spirit is certainly libertarian, in that you're trying to let people make decisions for themselves rather than coerce them. But that's on the one hand, but on the other hand, just as a microeconomist would say, it's not coercive when you decide to not buy something because the price is too high. You could say, well, by guiding prices in various markets, you're guiding behaviors in a way that is also based on choice architecture. So it's kind of a continuum, I'd say. One of the things that is a little tricky here is this question of the legitimacy of the institutions themselves. You know, very often the nudgers are not people who are sort of authorized to nudge. Yes. They're sort of taking it on their own, you know, to to innovate in this way. And many of them see what they're doing as a kind of mission of clarity and in providing information. And maybe that's just fine normatively. But others, you know, are interested in, you know, guiding people to websites or doing yes. things that might persuade them, perhaps against their will. And to the extent that nudges are used in that way, you know, I think that there's a healthy normative debate about what's fair game.
That's true. I mean, in Europe, for example, there's currently this ongoing debate about the eco-labels and the eco-label legitimacy, for example. Is there some state-normed eco-labels on food and beverages, while others are just made up, thereby playing with the customer's choice architecture in what can be considered a non-responsible way? For example, just a few days ago, I bought a yogurt in a supermarket, which ended up having 9 nudges depicted on it.
You found 9 nudges on a single package?
Oh yes, that was crazy. They were depicted by like the color indicating that it is ecologically sustainable, different eco labels, the positioning in the supermarket, so loads of different crazy factors. So, and when you think about it, it's absolutely crazy. So coming back to the initial question, do you think that the legitimacy of the initiative matters? And how can this be addressed in the rather less regulated private sector, for example?
Well, I guess the question is whether their legitimacy is being imperiled by falsehoods. I mean, if the, you know, for example, it's one thing to say that something is organic and another thing to say it's organic when it's not actually organic, or yes. That it's sustainably farmed when it is or isn't. And so that's a case where you'd like to have some regulatory body certifying things as being GMO or not or whatever. So that, I guess, one way to undermine the legitimacy of nudges is if it's a free-for-all and anybody can say anything they want, including things that might be misleading. There's sort of a presumption that you're not going to mislead people, but that's not actually baked into nudging per se. It's just a kind of separate norm.
That's right. I think one really has to differentiate here between the private and the public sector. So, for example, do I, as the state, on the one hand, want people to decrease their carbon emission to generate societal welfare, or do I as a company want people to just simply click on my website? You know? So the legitimacy of the institution is quite hard to evaluate.
That's right. And it goes fairly deeply, because it's, you know, a lot of nudges are based on claims that are not necessarily false, but could be false. And so I think that, you know, when we're in the world of nudging, there's kind of this view that, you know, let 100 flowers bloom, but it's not clear whether that is a problem of nudging or that's just a problem of an information environment that is often fraught with misleading content.
Now, this accusation of misleading content was also part of quite a big debate in Germany or in Europe. So we previously mentioned this Nutri-Score, which aimed to show which food was nutritiously healthy or which was not. And this was placed on all kinds of packages, food packages, food and beverage packages in Germany. And obviously this process also involved a lot of lobby work, which is kind of unavoidable in the policy process, which leads to people questioning the legitimacy of the initiators of these policy measures. But let's come back to the initial question of nudging. We previously discussed individual agency as a potential matter of enhancing policy effectiveness. What I found quite interesting, and what has also been extensively discussed in the literature, is the idea of incorporating individual deliberation into the policy proposals. So, to what extent can this kind of resolve criticism of nudges being too paternalistic? And can this reflective element, so this deliberative element, combine the idea of self-prophecy and implementation intentions on the one hand, and the descriptive norms on the other hand, into behavioral policy instruments? I know it's kind of a big question.
It's a great question. It's actually quite, it's kind of a kind of foundational question, because what's interesting about the idea of deliberation and cognitive effort is that in some ways it runs counter to the underlying presumption of why nudges might be influential, namely that people are just not expending much cognitive effort on things. And as they go through their daily lives, they're just buffeted about by small irrelevant things because they're not really paying attention. You know, you're talking to them about, say, politics, but they're really more interested in, you know, getting their grocery list checked off. And so if you kind of catch them at the right moment, you might be able to deflect their behavior a little bit. But ultimately, it's because they're time constrained, or they're at least not attending to certain things fully. So one of the questions is, if you're going to aspire to bring people into a more deliberative or reflective mode, is that sustainable, given that the underlying presumption of nudging is that they don't have those tastes, or they don't have the kind of budget for that in terms of their time?
So would you say this is rather an operational matter?
Operational issues, but also issues about basic tastes and preferences. You know, okay, what kinds of people are interested in deliberating or reflecting? Because if you think about what is going on with a lot of nudges, a lot of it is sort of presupposing that people are only going to spend a few moments on a choice.
Yes, definitely. And also the idea of being overflown by these stimuli is quite interesting. You previously mentioned that people might be less reactive to certain interventions if they are overflown by them. So I recently heard the funny word annoyance cost, describing the churn of participants resulting from them being annoyed by the initial intervention. So taking into account this into our discussion, we kind of have initial nudges on the one hand and deliberative elements on the other hand. So research by Sinchayan Banerjee and Professor Dr. Beta John proposes a combination of these strategies called the Nudge Plus, where nudges are combined with deliberative elements. So would you consider this combined approach as rather advantageous?
I think it's really an open question, and it's an empirical question, an empirical question that very importantly hinges not just on the short-run effects, but the long-term effects. Because if people come to view the calorie labeling and every other thing that they might find on products off-putting, they just might, as a matter of habit, ignore them. So I think that, or they might be so habituated to them that they actually fall for some tricks. In the United States, which is the land of potato chips, the United States has many good things and bad things about it, but we probably lead the league in terms of the number of potato chips and the calorie count of our potato chips. It has become fashionable now for sellers of potato chips to give you a calorie count on the label in big print, but then on the fine print, it points out that the little package contains two servings, not one, and they're giving the calorie count per serving. Well, if you've become nudge oriented and you look for the calorie count in big print, well, you're going to fall for a trick. And so I think this is the question of whether these kinds of things are sustainable ultimately, or whether people either fall for things that are untoward or become indifferent to them altogether.
Thank you for your elaborations on this matter. With regards to time, we now want to come to an end and take a look into the future. Considering the recent developments in behavioral public policy, what do you think will be the next interesting topic emerging within this field, and why should we look into it?
I guess my suggestion would be to look for applications outside the high-income countries. If one were to look at low-income countries or middle-income countries, one would find a lot of places with vast populations that are not overrun with messaging and where the level of state capacity is very low. And so if you're in that kind of situation and you want to solve widespread public policy problems, your state-led options are fairly minimal because there effectively is no state. So it's not as though you're going to be able to tax things or you're going to be able to send police. Yes. Because there's essentially no capacity for that sort of thing. So that's why I think one of the most promising areas for nudge-oriented thinking is narrative entertainment, because it's done on a vast scale and it has long-term effects on behaviors and attitudes. And the net effect is quite large, especially given that it's highly scalable and relatively cost-effective. So as I would see it, if I were to put my first dollar into the next nudge intervention, it would probably be social problems in low-income countries.
Thank you very much. This has been a pleasure. First of all, a huge thank you to Professor Dr. Green for his time. This interview has given us some valuable insights into the nature of behavioral public policy as a new interesting addition to the public policy toolkit by appealing to individual agency. So what we really see here is that individual agency matters and also deliberation. So therefore, it would be interesting to look a bit deeper into these kind of topics. Nevertheless, as we've seen, a lot is still unknown, leaving a lot of room for future research. Also, thank you guys for listening. From now onwards, we will publish episodes more frequently on this channel, discussing topics in business, economics, and politics. To always be up to date, follow us on Instagram or Spotify. My name is Philip, and this was On Point Politics. See you next time.